Humphreys, otherwise known as Chris Humphreys, and you're listening to Authors Like Us.
There we go.
Yeah, we're live.
All right, so I guess Happy New Year, right? It's still early January, and we are going to play shortly the second part of the Chris C.C. Humphreys interview.
Yep, and the second part is actually a little bit shorter than the first part was. Not much, but it's a little bit shorter.
That's why we're rambling on out.
Exactly. We have to, you know, get more time. And
no, we have to talk about... we need to tell everyone what we did for...
We need to tell people who we are.
All right. I'm Lee Edward Foti.
I'm James McCann.
And you're listening to
Authors Like Us.
We'll get better at this eventually.
I think that's our thing, though, now.
What, that we bumble along?
Yeah.
Well, I think listeners might be amused to know that we did also have a near-death experience since the holidays, because we went up to Cyprus. Didn't you drag me up to Cyprus? Was that
yes.
where it was?
And yeah, we went,
and it was dark, and we were going to do all these fun things like tubing, but I didn't have any of the proper clothes.
No, not even a hat.
No, I had a hat, but I didn't wear it.
Oh, okay.
And then the toboggan hill, or the tubing hill, was full, right?
Full, yeah. So we went on a hike.
And remember, it was getting really dark.
Yeah.
And we met those two guys coming down, and they kind of stopped us and said, "You shouldn't go any further. Do you have a flashlight?"
And we said, "No. We had no gear.
Do you have any gear? Yeah. No. Do you have food? No. Do you have a cell phone? No.
We're news reports waiting to happen."
Yeah, exactly. And you remember you needed that rope to climb up the icy hill?
Yeah.
And then we did that in the pitch dark, and then I think that's the point where we realized that we probably would die. And,
yeah, we'll get lost.
So we came back. But I'm proud of us for that moment.
Yeah, it was good. It wasn't as bad as the first time I went up Cyprus, and it was pouring rain and so foggy you couldn't see with, you know, more than 2 feet in front of your car.
Right.
So, I mean, at least it wasn't, you know,
that was
scary.
Was that, you went on Christmas Day?
That was the Sunday before Christmas.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah.
Because Christmas time, you stayed in Vancouver.
Yeah.
I went back to my parents.
Yep.
So I have to tell this amusing story, because you and my parents live in the Okanagan, up in this, well, it's a big house, but it looks like a cabin. It's in the woods. And you and I...
Just down the street from the pet cemetery.
Good point. And you and I went there, actually, around Thanksgiving, not for Thanksgiving, but around Thanksgiving to do some school visits through the Raise a Reader program.
Yeah.
And as you remember, we drove up there. I can't remember what time we got there, midday. I hopped out of the car.
Midday, yeah.
And my dad comes up, and I go to hug my dad. We do that. And he said, "I can't hug you." And I said, "Why?" He goes, "I'm covered in blood." And at this point, I'm like, "Oh, my God, what's going on?" And my dad, living in a rural community, he's a hunter-gatherer, and he had just hunted. So he had...
Yes, a deer without his fur on.
Yeah, that's a nice way to put it.
So we can still keep this PG.
Yeah, well, rest assured, listeners, we were as horrified as you are. This is my childhood, but it's been a long time, so I was... Anyways, why I'm telling you that story is because...
I have a feeling you were still... even in your childhood, though.
No, I was, but at that moment, I was just like, "Oh, my, what is this?" Remember, I told you not to look, which is a very silly thing to do.
Yeah, because then I had to look.
Because you look. Because you didn't even know what I was telling you not to look at.
How do you not look when somebody says, "Don't look"?
I know. I just...
You know, it's like, don't go through this door.
Well, we would always do that.
Exactly.
So, at Christmas time, this is only a couple months later, and this is my same dad, and many of my students famously know that I'm not a fan of Anne of Green Gables, and I don't think you are either.
No.
We're just not into the literature of drinking tea and arranging summer picnics and sojourns with possible suitors.
Not that there's anything wrong with it.
No, it's just not,
it's
just not our thing.
Yeah. Unless a zombie or a vampire pops out one day and the vampire slayer.
So just how they've done the new zombie books for Jane Austen, maybe they'll do zombie Anne of Green Gables. Maybe you should do zombie Anne of Green Gables.
Anne of Green Gables and zombies.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
The zombies are taking over the Gables.
Yeah.
And only Anne can save the day.
Right. right now there's so many people shuddering, calling blasphemy. But, you know, with my students, anytime they take any little nugget of information about me and it becomes like lore, or they expand it till it becomes legend. So, famously, you know, if I even gaze upon Anna Green Gable's book, I may shrivel up and die in my students' imagination. Yeah. So, I go home at Christmas and I'm there for a few days and, you know, and my dad says to me, oh, it's time for my show. I'm going to watch my show. And I'm thinking, oh, what's my dad's show? Like, there must be, are there hunting shows? I don't know. Something is either hunting or fishing or something. Well, he's watching the entire Anna Green Gables television series. They were rerunning it over the holidays. And I was completely in shock. My jaw was on the floor. I'm like, why are you watching? And not my mom. My mom wasn't watching it. It wasn't like he was watching it with my mom or because of my mom. He was watching it for him. So I was subjected to about 6 hours of Anna Green Gables and was particularly amused by the climax of the whatever episode that was, where she discussed the possibility of arranging a walk with this possible suitor.
Oh.
It was spine-tingling action.
Yes.
My dad was very happy.
Yes. Not a lot of explosions in that game.
No. Not that I always need things that go boom, but we are boys.
Yeah.
But didn't you... so that was my Christmas, your Christmas. Didn't you also have another attempt at Cypress Mountain?
Yeah, I went up Cypress. We were going to go snowshoeing, but there wasn't enough snow, which bodes well for the Olympics. Yeah, way to go. And what happened? Boy, we went up there and we just wanted to go for a hike. It was a lot.
I thought you told me you went snowshoeing and then, like, much later you confided to me that there was no snowshoes involved.
Yeah, no snowshoes.
So then you didn't go snowshoeing.
No, we went hiking.
Right,
yeah.
In snow.
Yeah, but the snowshoe trail, because we actually took a wrong turn. We went on the free trail, then we took a wrong turn. We wound up on the trail you're supposed to pay for.
But that doesn't mean you went snowshoeing.
GPS. It was like snowshoeing.
I know, but if I go on, like, if I drive my little Toyota on the, I don't know, the Indy 500, that doesn't mean I went on the Indy 500, does it?
Yeah.
Oh.
Well, if you do it on the Indy 500, I mean, if you do it on the highway and say it was an Indy 500, then it wouldn't be.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So you were supposed to take a, why would you take a GPS? GPS take.
You're supposed to actually, well, when you go on the back trails, you're supposed to have a tracker.
Like a GPS.
Yeah, and you're supposed to sign in and out so that they can see who signed in.
Oh, dear God. You didn't do that?
We did none of that. No. And, I mean, of course not.
I mean, you should hang the tracker, like the little beacon around your neck or something.
Yeah. Yeah, I should actually have it implanted underneath my skin.
But then then one day, I just had this vision, these rangers will, in the command center. I know, but in the command center, and I don't even know if they have one, but in my mind, they do, and it has computers. And it's like, beep, 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 and they'll see it beeping, and they'll go to find you, and they'll go, that's strange, that's not James, it's just a giant bear. Why is that bear going beep, 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 beep?
The Canadian version of open water.
Yeah.
Yep.
So you got caught by the ranger?
We got caught by the ranger, and we're informed that because of us, they wouldn't be able to pay his salary, and that we should promptly go and pay for the trail.
Oh, this is lovely. So at Christmas time, you put someone out of work.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that was my Christmas gift to him. So we informed him that, you know, we'd love to pay his salary, and just didn't realize that we were on a different trail.
He clearly doesn't know your reputation, that you get lost.
Where we entered, there were no signs. But when we came out, there was a giant sign.
Well, I'm on your side, of course, but having traveled a lot with you and stuff...
There probably could have been a sign.
I'm not convinced there wasn't a giant sign at the front of the trail that said, James, before entering trail, you should sign in. James McCann, I'm talking to you. This sign was built specifically for you.
Yeah, so that was... but luckily, we made it out of the... out of the woods.
You live to...
Tell
you live to taunt death another day.
Yeah, we were going to go and have a burger that day, but the mountain was closing at 4. So we actually wound up not having we had hot chocolate, which was nice.
Okay.
But, yeah.
Well, I guess with our terrible tales of survival, that leads in nicely to the next part two of C.C. Humphreys, who actually writes books about people who actually have to confront real danger.
Yes. Not danger that they've just
created in their head. Yeah.
On themselves.
All right. Enjoy.
I remember you coming in
to talk to my students once, too. And my students being absolutely fascinated by some of the stories you told. And I was actually wondering if you would tell the story about how you learned how to use the slingshot.
Oh.
Because you told us while working on a movie set.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. That's a good story. In my headier acting days, I played the role of a Jewish zealot who became Rome's top gladiator in a biblical Roman epic called AD, Anno Domini.
Was this a play or a movie?
Miniseries.
Oh, okay.
It was an NBC miniseries.
Okay.
Mid-80s. We filmed it for 10 months in Tunisia. And it was my crack at Hollywood, actually, because I, in fact, used it as a vehicle and went out and lived in Los Angeles for 2 years in the mid-80s after that. But it was a fantastic part because, as some of your listeners will know, and if they don't, I'm going to tell them now. I became an actor so I could leap around with bladed weaponry. You know, I was a fencer at school. I love all that stuff.
You could leap around with bladed weaponry and get paid for it.
Well, exactly, yeah. Exactly. That was the gag, really. And so, you know,
because James leaps around with bladed weaponry all the time. Nobody pays you.
Yeah. No. Well, Sam, they're not really paying me anymore, but they did for a while. And Caleb, the Jewish zealot gladiator, was an amazing part to play, and at a very, you know, high level, obviously. But one of the things that James was asking about was the slingshot, which at one stage Caleb, my character, had to attack the Romans, and of course he used the weapon of choice for all good zealots, which was the slingshot. And I was down in Tunisia. I've never used a slingshot, obviously, and I was being physically conditioned by this lunatic ex Argyle and Sutherland officer, ex-Congo mercenary called Bill Weston.
Where did they dig him up from?
Oh, he was a stunt coordinator. But okay. He was frankly like that. He's very well spoken. He could obviously kill you with his little finger. You know, he was one of those guys. You know, but he'd become a Buddhist, which is an extraordinary thing. Anyway, Bill.
There's a book in there somewhere.
Oh yeah, but Bill used to torment me on the beach every morning, like 6 a.m. He'd get me up and get me down to the beach, and I'd be on this beach. There was no one on this beach either. This was fairly early on in the holiday season in North Africa. We were staying, you know, in hotels that were on the beach, but there was a stretch of beach and no one there. And I'd be down there, you know, doing star jumps and press-ups and all these outrageous British commando exercises to get fit and in shape. And then he'd leave me with a slingshot and say, well, practice at like 6:30 or 7 o'clock in the morning by then. And it was wonderful. I was totally awake and totally alive and trying to use this slingshot, figure out how it worked. You know, we're talking the slingshot of the David and Goliath weapon.
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah, we're not talking the Bart Simpson slingshot. We're talking the old
thing, yeah. So anyway, I was down there working with this not very good slingshot and trying to practice it. And the guy who ran the camel concessions on the beach came down the beach with the, you know, he'd give people camel rides. And he had his mummy camel and his baby camel, and he brought his camel down the beach. And he stops by me, and he's looking at me. We're only two people on the beach, right? He goes, what are you doing? They speak French in Tunisia, right? And I can get by, so in French. So he said, well, you know, what are you doing? And I said, well, I'm in this film. He said, oh, yeah, we hadn't actually started filming yet, right? We were just training and stuff. And he said, oh, yeah, I've heard of this film, yeah. And he said, but what are you doing here now with this? And I said, oh, it's a slingshot. He said, yeah, I know. We use these all the time. You know, Tunisian boys, we hunt with these things, right? I went, really, do you? He said, yeah. I said, well, do you know how to use it? He said, sure, yeah, I used to be really good at it. I said, well, could you show me? He said, yeah, sure. Tied up his camels, stepped off his mummy camel, and gave me a 2-hour slingshot lesson, basically. I had a seminar with the Tunisian slingshot champion.
So I just had this moment in my imagination where he picked up a slingshot and, like, hit a snake from across he slung it out into the ocean and hit a starfish or something.
No, didn't quite work out like that, but he did show me some very cool stuff, including how to sort of get it off your neck and loaded and spinning and fired in like 5 seconds from a hidden position, which I then used in the film setup.
So it strikes me, is this weapon not a little bit dangerous to the... So you're really experiential in your writing. Like, you experience a lot of these things and inhabit the characters, usually physically. Like,
yeah.
You're actually dressed as them and...
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
you know... perform them almost.
Yes, I mean, some of them certainly. I mean, you know, you both know, you're writers. We draw from our own experience, whether it's very directly in terms of those sort of things, or just imaginatively, where we fix on something in our life which we've done, which we can then transfer in our imagination to our character, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I... And we all, I suppose we all tend to write books that we're,
you know, that, that is within, even if it's a wild fantasy, it's still somehow within our gambit, perhaps.
Right,
you know?
Yeah. Some grounded, like I know for me, writing fantasy for kids, I still get inspiration from going to castles and things like that, because those are the types of environments my characters go to, so...
Yeah.
I always say when people ask me, well, fantasy is so easy because you don't have to do any research or, you know, just have to make it up. I'm like, well, that's the hard part.
No, geez,
you have to make it up.
I've just, this is news, gentlemen, news. I've just on
you
Friday.
You heard it here first.
Just on Friday, I've delivered for the third and hopefully final time my latest YA book
to
my publisher in New York. And
is this a standalone project?
This is a standalone, and it's the first one of my books that's almost, not entirely because it starts and ends in New York.
Mm-hmm.
But it's almost, it's a fantasy world. I've created a fantasy world called Gollum, which is the land of the fabulous beast. Because the story's about a girl and a unicorn, basically, and the unicorn lives in Gollum and draws the girl from Manhattan, present-day Manhattan, into Gollum. But what you're saying is absolutely true. To create that world, the fantasy world, was far tougher than all the historical research I've done.
Okay.
Yeah. In lots of ways.
Well, because really, it's the, as the old saying goes, the devil's in the details, right? You can tell when people don't.
I would say the thing that most, I mean, it inspires me, but in a different way. The thing that most takes me away out of my head is swimming in the ocean.
Right.
That to me is, that's one of the main reasons I live in Vancouver. So I can spend most of the summer swimming most days. I love that. But in a way that can be inspiring as well, because I get so charged up by it that I almost want to grab a pen as I run out of the water, you know.
But you find that helps clear your head and
clears my head. Exactly. It puts me back in touch with the physical world, you know, because as you both know, it's when you're in your base. I write in a basement, so I'm in a basement in my basement every day with my people I've invented. You know, it's one of the great things that about, you know, occasionally dabbling my toe in the acting world again, like I just did a play, is that I get to work collaboratively again. You know, and we all know how it's wonderful to be able to create by yourself, but it also can be a bit scary and a bit, you know, you've got to do it every day, and yet you have to do it, you know, and that puts its own pressures on. So if anything that will really, you know, take me out of myself like that. I mean, I quite like watching sports as well, but not in a big way. But I love rugby. That was my sport at school, so I love watching rugby.
And fencing too.
And fencing, yeah. I'm actually thinking of taking up fencing again.
See, I don't.
I've been talking about this a lot. Yeah.
For me, I have to watch a sport that I would never play, because otherwise, then I might start.
Imagine yourself.
I would just go play it almost. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think you would. You know, you. If you swam in the ocean, it would also take you away, because you'd be so terrified of sharks and stingrays.
And wanting to breathe again.
Well, I didn't say drowning. I said swimming.
Swimming and drowning are pretty much the same thing.
I'm thinking also the other thing. I mean, it's an interesting question, because is there other stuff that's sort of counter-inspirational? And I'm thinking of things that might deaden you as opposed to transport you. I don't know. I mean, taxes deaden me, I must say. You know, I've just done them.
Must find Canada very hard then.
Yeah, that's right. There's very few things that I'm a very positive person. There's very few things that I'm not able to convert into something positive, at least after a while. I mean, I get my share of, why has that happened? But then after a while, I think...
Not something that you just sort of magically go poof and this book appears.
Yeah.
You know, there's actual work involved.
And
any kind of job, it's always easier to say to yourself, well, maybe I'll work after I do this, or I'll do this first.
Procrastination, yes.
Exactly.
Yeah. Wonderful.
And people will sometimes mix up, I think, procrastination and writer's block.
I
don't know if you ever found that.
Yes, I mean, I suppose. I'm not a great believer in writer's block, to be honest. But
I actually don't believe it exists.
No, I think it's, you know, it's like surgeon's block, you know. I suppose you could get the yips as a surgeon. Yeah. You know,
always
the yips, your hands shake, you know, but you can't putt in golf or something.
Yeah.
But not that I play golf, but...
I always liken it to mechanics and say, what would happen if you took your car to the mechanic and he said, well, I'm not really feeling inspired.
Yeah.
Do your oil change.
Right,
bring it back tomorrow.
I say that to students when I teach them. You know, they ask about writer's block sometimes, and I say there's always something you can do that will help you with your writing.
You might
not be, you know, completely ready to compose a Shakespearean sonnet that morning, but I bet there's some character work you can do. I bet there's some
For me, structure. It's drawing, right? Yeah. So I start to draw.
Well, there you are.
Still creating. I use the term writer's block because it's one that students can relate to.
Yeah.
I kind of agree with you guys. I don't believe it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it's exactly, you can always do something.
There's always something, yeah. I mean, the times that I've, you know, it's very rare that I walk away from my desk, you know, sometimes you're feeling less than you think, you know, I think I'll just leave it there. But it's very rare. Usually, if I'm thinking, well, I'm going to leave. If I sit there another 15 minutes, this has happened like on four occasions in my life. The turning point of the book has come at that moment.
Really?
Yeah.
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 So it's the old, it's the darkest before the dawn.
Well,
right?
It's the old
cliche.
Yeah, absolutely.
I actually got my best piece of advice on how to get over writer's block from you, believe it or not.
Good Lord.
Yeah, there was something you had said, actually, I think it was on your blog.
Oh.
And it was, you had taught a course, I'm trying to think of where it was in the Maritimes. I can't remember where it was.
Yeah, that's right. I did know. We went to Halifax. Did a master class.
Yeah. And you had mentioned to them that you had told them that to allow themselves to write their first draft badly.
Yeah.
That the first draft belongs to them and no one else. And it was actually that piece of advice that that has helped me to get through a lot of my sort of quote unquote writer's block, because I say to myself, you know, this doesn't have to be perfect. This is terrible.
Yeah, yeah.
Just get it out on paper,
right?
Yeah, because you can edit what's on the paper, you can't edit the blank page.
Absolutely, that's a very good way of putting it. Yeah, no, that's one
well,
of the first.
I think you put it that way, and we just stole it.
Well, maybe so. No, that's a good way of putting it. Because, yeah, I mean, that's when I teach. That's one of the first things I teach. Is always that. There was a woman who's approached me. She was actually an air hostess on a flight, and she started telling me all this stuff, and I made the mistake of mentioning I was a writer. That's it.
And you can't get away.
I can't.
You were searching feverishly for your parachute.
Yeah, that's right.
I was in the bathroom for 3 hours.
Yeah. I know she's tracked me down since, and I did meet her the other day and gave her some advice about the story she has to tell. But that's one of the things I'm telling her. I see, and she starts showing her stuff to everyone all the time. I said, if you're serious about writing it, stop doing that. Because anytime you retell the story to someone, you're going to change the story. You're going to change it according to their reaction. If they're full of praise, you're going to be deluded. If they're full of criticism, you're going to be depressed. Just don't stop showing it to people. And just start working on it yourself, you know, I don't know whether she's one of those people who has to tell everyone everything, so I'm not sure she's going to listen, but you never know. I think it's good advice.
Great advice for a lot of our listeners who might be young writers, or older writers too, but I'm always thinking of my students, right? So that's really fantastic wisdom.
Yeah, I think the stuff that held me back as a writer, that probably held every writer who isn't published but wants to be a writer, and is a writer in a way already, a writer in embryo, the thing that holds us all back is the idea that we're going to be criticized on what we write. And if you say to yourself, the first draft is only for me, no one will see it, so no one can criticize it. You give yourself permission to write poorly, badly, grammatically, bad spelling, anything you like. But there will be in the pile of not very good stuff there, there'll probably be a sentence or a character speaking or something you'll be able to pluck out and go, aha, that's what that piece of writing is about. And that's going to lead you into something else, a springboard for something else.
Hmm.
So I think it's vital that people just allow themselves to just go. I mean, the people who can do it, you know, like Hemingway, you can spend 3 days working on a paragraph. You know, fantastic. I love Hemingway, actually. I just reread another short story recently. People hold themselves back so much by the fear of being.
Of me, like the first book I published, like that was it. Like this was, you know, and then you realize, oh, no, that's just one.
Mm.
If you're a writer, you're always writing and you keep writing. You're not basing your career or your livelihood or anything on one piece, right? It's just a little
stone among on the path. Right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And there's going to be many more, and you have to just move on to the next one.
Yep.
Actually, I mean,
yeah.
This is I'm already moving on to my next one. You know, probably next week I have
right.
to get going with that.
Yeah.
So
yeah, that's cool. Well, do we have any other questions? Do you have
any final thoughts?
Any bathroom stories?
Any bathroom stories?
We always have these authors.
Every author seems to have this bathroom story.
Where they get locked in a cubicle, or oh. you travel all over the world, and you must have been in some interesting...
interesting toilets?
For me, it was Egypt, but, you know.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I'm sure I was in some interesting toilets in Egypt, actually. Actually, I was in Cairo Airport, but that's not a story I can tell on.
yeah, we're not... The purpose of this question
isn't
to embarrass
yourself. Yes. I can't think offhand of any sort of major
okay.
toilet stories.
Just
but,
checking. It seems to be a theme.
Yeah.
Any last pieces of advice you want to
I think we've. I mean, if people, you know, if there are students listening, then I think what we would. Sorry?
So they've got quite a bit of advice from this.
Well, I think, you know, what we were just saying, you know, absolutely. You can only do it by doing it. You have to write, and you have to just keep doing it, because if it. Eventually, I mean, people get discouraged, but if it is good enough, it will get published. You have to believe that. If you make it as good as you can possibly make it, then it will get published somewhere. And you have to keep believing that. But there are various ways you can approach that. For a start, you have to be true to your own vision and pursue that to the ultimate degree. But then once you feel you've nailed that as much as you can, you have to show it to someone you trust, who will then say, okay, it's your vision, but you haven't communicated it to me, right? That's what I think a good editor does. A good editor is not there to write your book. We have an expression in England, you don't buy a dog and bark yourself. You know, an editor is not there to do the barking. You're the dog. You do the barking. An editor's there to say, bark at him, bark at him. You're barking too much, or whatever. I'm straining this metaphor. Straining the leash of this metaphor. But a good editor will say, will seek clarity, not change, really.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Okay. And I guess that's it.
I guess that's it. Thanks, Chris.
And we're going to get a couple pictures.
Okay. You can take a picture.
And Lee Edward Foti, and you've been listening to
Authors Like Us.